that turned out to be Omar Khayyam. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. That, in turn, made me think of some magical place where an invisible moving finger would write terrible things in the sand, and I had this story. It has one of my favorite endings. Maybe not up there with August Heat by W.F. Harvey. That one's a classic, but in the same neighborhood.
The Dune, read by Edward Herman.
As the judge climbs into the kayak beneath a bright morning sky, a slow and clumsy process that takes him almost 5 minutes, he reflects that an old man's body is nothing but a sack filled with aches and indignities. 80 years ago, when he was 10, he jumped into a wooden canoe and cast off, with no bulky life jacket, no worries, and certainly with no pee dribbling into his underwear. Every trip out to the little unnamed island began with a great and uneasy excitement. Now there is only unease and pain that seems centered deep in his guts and radiates everywhere. But he still makes the trip. Many things have lost their allure in these shadowy later years. Most things, really. But not the dune on the far side of the island. Never the dune. In the early days of his exploration, he expected the dune to be gone after every big storm, and following the 1944 hurricane that sank the USS Raleigh off Siesta Key, he was sure it would be. But when the skies cleared, the island was still there. So was the dune, although the 100-mile-an-hour winds should have blown all the sand away, leaving only the bare rocks. Over the years, he has debated back and forth about whether the magic is in him or in the dune. Perhaps it's both. But surely, most of it is in the dune. Since 1932, he has crossed this short stretch of water thousands of times. Usually there's nothing but rocks and bushes and sand. Sometimes there is something else. Settled in the kayak at last, he paddles slowly from the beach to the island, his frizz of white hair blowing around his mostly bald skull. A few turkey buzzards wheel overhead, making their ugly conversation. Once he was the son of the richest man on the Florida Gulf Coast. Then he was a lawyer. Then he was a judge on the Pinellas County Circuit. Then he was appointed to the state Supreme Court. There was talk, during the Reagan years, of a nomination to the United States Supreme Court, but that never happened. And a week after the idiot Clinton became president, Judge Harvey Beecher, just judge to his many acquaintances, he has no real friends, in Sarasota, Osprey, Nokomis, and Venice, retired. Hell, he never liked Tallahassee anyway. It's cold up there. Also, it's too far from the island, and its peculiar dune. On these early morning kayak trips, paddling the short distance on smooth water, he's willing to admit that he's addicted to it. But who wouldn't be addicted to a thing like this? On the rocky east side, a gnarled bush juts from the split in a guano-splattered rock. This is where he ties up, and he's always careful with the knot. It wouldn't do to be stranded out here. His father's estate, that's how he still thinks of it, although the elder Beecher has been gone for 40 years now, covers almost 2 miles of prime Gulf Front property. The main house is far inland on the Sarasota Bay side, and there would be no one to hear him yelling. Tommy Curtis, the caretaker, might notice him gone and come looking. More likely, he would just assume the judge was locked up in his study, where he often spends whole days, supposedly working on his memoirs. Once upon a time, Mrs. Riley might have become nervous if he didn't come out of the study for lunch, but now he hardly ever eats at noon. She calls him nothing but a stuffed string, but never to his face. There's no other staff, and both Curtis and Riley know he can be cross when he's interrupted. Not that there's really much to interrupt. He hasn't added so much as a line to the memoirs in 2 years, and in his heart he knows they will never be finished. The unfinished recollections of a Florida judge? No great loss there. The one story he could write is the one he never will. The judge wants no talk at his funeral about how, in his last years, a previously fine intellect was corrupted by senility. He's even slower getting out of the kayak than he was getting in, and turns turtle once, wetting his shirt and trousers in the little waves that run up the gravelly shingle. Beecher is not discommoded. It isn't the first time he's fallen, and there's no one to see him. He supposes it's unwise to continue these trips at his age, even though the island is so close to the mainland. But stopping isn't an option. An addict is an addict is an addict. Beecher struggles to his feet and clutches his belly until the last of the pain subsides. He brushes sand and shells from his trousers, double-checks his mooring rope, then spots one of the turkey buzzards perched on the island's largest rock, peering down at him. "Hi!" he shouts in the voice he now hates, cracked and wavering, the voice of a fishwife. "Hi, you bugger! Get on about your business!" After a brief rustle of its raggedy wings, the turkey buzzard sits right where it is. Its beady eyes seem to say, "But, Judge, today you are my business." Beecher stoops, picks up a larger shell, and shies it at the bird. This time it does fly away, the sound of its wings like rippling cloth. It soars across the short stretch of water and lands on his dock. Still, the judge thinks, a bad omen. He remembers a fellow on the Florida State Patrol telling him once, the turkey buzzards didn't just know where carrion was. They also knew where carrion would be. "I can't tell you," the patrolman said, "how many times I've seen those ugly bastards circling a spot on the Tamiami where there's a fatal wreck a day or two later. Sounds crazy, I know, but just about any Florida road cop will tell you the same." There are almost always turkey buzzards out here on the little no-name island. He supposes it smells like death to them. And why not? What else? The judge sets off on the little path he has beaten over the years. He will check the dune on the other side, where the sand is beach fine instead of stony and shelly. And then he will return to the kayak and drink his little jug of cold tea. He may doze a while in the morning sun. He dozes often these days, supposes most nonagenarians do. And when he wakes, if he wakes, he'll make the return trip. He tells himself that the dune will be just a smooth, blank upslope of sand, as it is most days. But he knows better. That damn buzzard knew better, too. He spends a long time on the sandy side, with his age-warped fingers clasped in a knot behind him. His back aches, his shoulders ache, his hips ache, his knees ache. Most of all, his gut aches. But he pays these things no mind. Perhaps later, but not now. He looks at the dune, and what is written there. Anthony Wayland arrives at Beecher's Pelican Point estate bang on 7 p.m., just as promised. One thing the judge has always appreciated, both in the courtroom and out of it, is punctuality. And the boy is punctual. He reminds himself never to call Wayland boy to his face, although this being the South, son is okay. Wayland wouldn't understand that when you're 90, any fellow under the age of 40 looks like a boy. "Thank you for coming," the judge says, ushering Wayland into his study. It's just the two of them. Curtis and Mrs. Riley have long since gone to their homes in Nokomis Village. "You brought the necessary document?" "Yes, indeed, Judge," Wayland says. He opens his attorney's briefcase and removes a thick document bound by a large steel clip. The pages aren't vellum, as they would have been in the old days, but they are rich and heavy just the same. At the top of the first, in forbidding Gothic type, what the judge has always thought of as graveyard type, are the words, "Last Will and Testament of Harvey L. Beecher." "You know, I'm kind of surprised you didn't draft this document yourself. You've probably forgotten more Florida probate law than I've ever learned." That might be true, the judge says in his driest tone. At my age, folks tend to forget a great deal. Wayland flushes to the roots of his hair. I didn't mean... I know what you mean, son, the judge says. No offense taken. Not a mite. But since you ask, you know that old saying about how a man who serves as his own lawyer has a fool for a client? Wayland grins. Heard it and used it plenty of times when I'm wearing my public defender hat and some sad sack wife abuser or hit and runner tells me he's going to go the DIY route in court. I'm sure you have. But here's the other half. A lawyer who serves as his own lawyer has a great fool for a client. Goes for criminal, civil, and probate law. So shall we get down to business? Time is short. This is something he means in more ways than one. They get down to business. Mrs. Riley has left decaf coffee, which Wayland rejects in favor of a Coca-Cola. He makes copious notes as the judge dictates the changes in his dry courtroom voice, adjusting old bequests and adding new ones. The major new one, $4 million, is to the Sarasota County Beach and Wildlife Preservation Society. In order to qualify, they must successfully petition the state legislature to have a certain island just off the coast of Pelican Point declared forever wild. They won't have a problem getting that done, the judge says. You can handle the legal for them yourself. I'd prefer pro bono, but of course that's up to you. One trip to Tallahassee should do it. It's a little spit of a thing, nothing growing there but a few bushes. Governor Scott and his Tea Party cronies will be delighted.
Why is that, Judge?
Because the next time Beach and Preservation comes to them begging money, they can say, didn't old Judge Beecher just give you $4 million? Get out of here, and don't let the door hit you in the ass on your way out.
Wayland agrees that this is probably just how it will go. Scott and his friends are all forgiving if they are not the ones doing it, and the two men move on to the smaller bequests.
Once I get a clean draft, we'll need two witnesses and a notary, Wayland says when they're finished. I'll get all that done with this draft here, just to be safe, the judge says. If anything happens to me in the interim, it should stand up. There's no one to contest it. I've outlived them all.
A wise precaution, Judge. It would be good to take care of it tonight. I don't suppose your caretaker and housekeeper...
won't be back until 8 tomorrow, Beecher says. But I'll make it the first order of business. Harry Staines on Vamo Road's a notary, and he'll be glad to come over before he goes into his office. He owes me a favor, or six. You give that document to me, son. I'll lock it in my safe.
I ought to at least make a... Wayland looks at the gnarled, outstretched hand and trails off. When a state Supreme Court judge, even a retired one, holds out his hand, demurrals must cease. What the hell, it's only an annotated draft anyway, soon to be replaced by a clean version. He passes the unsigned will over and watches as Beecher rises, painfully, and swings a picture of the Florida Everglades out on a hidden hinge. The judge enters the correct combination, making no attempt to hide the touchpad from view, and deposits the will on top of what looks to Wayland like a large and untidy heap of cash. Yikes.
There, Beecher says. All done and buttoned up. Except for the signing part, that is. How about a drink to celebrate? I have some fine single malt scotch.
Well, I guess one wouldn't hurt.
It never hurt me when I was your age, although it does now, so you'll have to pardon me for not joining you. Decaf coffee and a little sweet tea are the strongest drinks I take these days.
Ice?
Wayland holds up two fingers, and Beecher adds two cubes to the drink with the slow ceremony of old age. Wayland takes a sip, and high color immediately dashes into his cheeks. It is the flush, Judge Beecher thinks, of a man who enjoys his tipple. As Wayland sets his glass down, he says, "Do you mind if I ask what the hurry is? You're all right, I take it." The judge doubts if young Wayland takes it that way at all. He's not blind.
"A country fair," he says, seesawing one hand in the air and sitting down with a grunt and a wince.
Then, after consideration, he says, "Do you really want to know what the hurry is?" Waylon considers the question, and Beecher likes him for that. Then he nods. "It has to do with that island we took care of just now. Probably never even noticed it, have you?" "Can't say that I have. Most people don't. It barely sticks out of the water. The sea turtles don't even bother with that old island. Yet it's special. Did you know my grandfather fought in the Spanish-American War?" "No, sir, I did not." Waylon speaks with exaggerated respect, and Beecher knows the boy believes his mind is wandering. The boy is wrong. Beecher's mind has never been clearer. And now that he's begun, he finds that he wants to tell this story at least once before... well, before. "Yes. There's a photograph of him standing on top of San Juan Hill. It's around here someplace. Grampy claimed to have fought in the Civil War as well, but my research, for my memoirs, you understand, proved conclusively that he couldn't have. He would have been a mere child, if born at all. But he was quite the fanciful gentleman, and he had a way of making me believe the wildest tales. Why would I not? I was only a child, not long from believing in Kris Kringle and the Tooth Fairy." "Was he a lawyer, like you or your father?" "No, son, he was a thief. The original Light Finger Harry. Anything that wasn't nailed down. Only like most thieves who don't get caught, our current governor might be a case in point, he called himself a businessman. His chief business, and chief thievery, was land. He bought bug and gator-infested Florida acreage cheap and sold it dear to folks who must have been as gullible as I was as a child. Balzac once said, 'Behind every great fortune there is a great crime.' That's certainly true of the Beecher family. And please remember that you're my lawyer. Anything I say to you must be held in confidence." "Yes, Judge." Waylon takes another sip of his drink. It is by far the finest scotch he has ever drunk. "Grampy Beecher was the one who pointed that island out to me. I was 10. He had care of me for the day, and I suppose he wanted some peace and quiet. Or maybe what he wanted was a bit noisier. There was a pretty housemaid, and he may have been in hopes of investigating beneath her petticoats. So he told me that Edward Teach, better known as Blackbeard, had supposedly buried a great treasure out there. 'Nobody's ever found it, Havy,' he said. 'Havy's what he called me. 'But you might be the one, a fortune in jewels and gold doubloons.' You'll know what I did next. I suppose you went out there and left your grandfather to cheer up the maid." The judge nods, smiling. "I took the old wooden canoe we had tied up to the dock. Went like my hair was on fire, and my tail feathers were catching. Didn't take but 5 minutes to paddle out there. Takes me 3 times as long these days, and that's if the water's smooth. The island's all rock and brush on the landward side, but there's a dune of fine beach sand on the gulf side. It never goes away. In the 80 years I've been going out there, it never seems to change. At least not geographically." "Didn't find any treasure, I suppose?" "I did, in a way. But it wasn't jewels and gold. It was a name, written in the sand of that dune. As if with a stick, you know? Only I didn't see any stick. The letters were drawn deep, and the sun struck shadows into them, making them stand out almost as if they were floating."
"What was the name, Judge?"
"I think you have to see it written to understand."
The judge takes a sheet of paper from the top drawer of his desk, prints carefully, then turns the paper around so Waylon can read it. Robbie, R-O-B-I-E, LaDouche.
"All right," Waylon says, cautiously. "On any other day I would have gone treasure hunting with this very boy, because he was my best friend. And you know how boys are when they're best friends."
"Joined at the hip," Waylon says, smiling.
"Tight as a new key in a new lock," Waylon agrees. "But it was summer. and he'd gone off with his parents to visit his mama's people in Virginia or Maryland or some such northern clime. So I was on my own. But attend me closely, counselor. The boy's actual name was Robert La Doucette.
Again, Waylon says, all right. The judge thinks that sort of leading drawl could become annoying over time, but it isn't a thing he'll ever have to actually find out. So he lets it go.
He was my best friend, and I was his. But there was a whole gang of boys we ran around with, and everyone called him Robbie LaDouche. You follow?
I guess, Waylon says, but the judge can see he doesn't. That's understandable. Beecher has had a lot more time to think about these things, often on sleepless nights.
Remember that I was 10. If I had been asked to spell my friend's nickname, I would have done it just this way.
He taps Robbie LaDouche. Speaking almost to himself, he adds,
so some of the magic comes from me. It must come from me. The question is how much.
You're saying you didn't write that name in the sand?
No. I thought I made that clear.
One of your other friends, then?
They were all from Nokomis Village and didn't even know about that island. We never would have paddled out to such an uninteresting little rock on our own. Robbie knew it was there. He was also from the point, but he was hundreds of miles north.
All right.
My chum Robbie never came back from that vacation. We got worried a week or so later that he'd taken a fall while out horseback riding. He broke his neck, killed instantly. His parents were heartbroken. So was I, of course.
There is silence while Waylon considers this, while they both consider it. Somewhere far off, a helicopter beats at the sky over the gulf. The DEA looking for drug runners, the judge supposes. He hears them every night. It's the modern age, and in some ways, in many, he'll be glad to be shed of it. At last, Waylon says,
are you saying what I think you're saying? Well, I don't know, the judge says. What do you think I'm saying?
But Anthony Wayland is a lawyer, and refusing to be drawn in is an ingrained habit with him. Did you tell your grandfather?
On the day the telegram about Robbie came, he wasn't there to tell. He never stayed in one place for long. We didn't see him again for 6 months or more. No, I kept it to myself. And like Mary, after she gave birth to Jesus, I considered these things in my heart.
And what conclusion did you draw?
I kept canoeing out to that island to look at the dune. And that should answer your question. There was nothing, and nothing, and nothing. I guess I was on the verge of forgetting all about it. But then I went out one afternoon after school, and there was another name written in the sand, printed in the sand, to be courtroom exact. No sign of a stick that time either, although I suppose a stick could have been thrown into the water. This time the name was Peter Alderson. It meant nothing to me until a few days later. It was my chore to go out to the end of the road and get the paper, and it was my habit to scan the front page while I walked back up the drive, which, as you know from driving it yourself, is a good quarter mile long. In the summer, I'd also check on how the Washington Senators had done, because back then they were as close to a Southern team as we had. This particular day, a headline on the bottom of the front page caught my eye. Window washer killed in tragic fall. The poor guy was doing the third-floor windows of the Sarasota Public Library when the scaffolding he was standing on gave way. His name was Peter Alderson.
The judge can see from Wayland's face that he believes this is either a prank or some sort of elaborate fantasy the judge is spinning out. He can also see that Wayland is enjoying his drink, and when the judge moves to top it up, Wayland doesn't say no. And really, the young man's belief or disbelief is beside the point. It's just such a luxury to tell it.
Maybe you see why I go back and forth in my mind about where the magic lies, Beecher says. I knew Robbie, and the misspelling of his name was my misspelling. But I didn't know this window washer from Adam. In any case, that's when the dune really started to get a hold on me. I began going out every day when I was here, a habit that's continued into my very old age. I respect the place. I fear the place. But most of all, I'm addicted to the place. Over the years, many names have appeared on that dune, and the people the names belong to always die. Sometimes it's within the week, sometimes it's two, but it's never more than a month. Some have been people I knew, and if it's by a nickname I knew them, it's the nickname I see. One day in 1940, I paddled out there and saw Grampy Beecher drawn into the sand. He died in Key West 3 days later. Heart attack.
With the air of someone humoring a man who is mentally unbalanced but not actually dangerous, Wayland asks, "Did you never try to interfere with this process? Call your grandfather, for instance, and tell him to see a doctor?" Beecher shakes his head.
"I didn't know it was a heart attack until we got word from the Monroe County Medical Examiner, did I? Could have been an accident or even a murder. Certainly there were people who had reasons to hate my grandfather. His dealings were not of the purest sort."
"Still, he was your grandfather and all."
"The truth, Counselor, is that I was afraid. I felt, I still feel, as if there on that island, there's a hatch that's come ajar. On this side is what we are pleased to call the real world. On the other is all the machinery of the universe, running at top speed. Only a fool would stick his hand into such machinery in an attempt to stop it."
"Judge Beecher, if you want your paperwork to sail through probate, I'd keep quiet about all this. You might think there's no one to contest your will, but when large amounts of money are at stake, third and fourth cousins have a way of coming out of the woodwork, and you know the criterion, being of sound mind and body."
"I've kept it to myself for 80 years, Beecher says, and in his voice Wayland can hear objection overruled. "Never a word until now. And I'm sure you won't talk."
"Of course not," Wayland says.
"I was always excited on days when names appeared in the sand. Unhealthily excited, I'm sure. But terrified of the phenomenon only once. That single time I was deeply terrified, and fled back to the point in my canoe as if devils were after me. Shall I tell you?"
"Please." Wayland lifts his drink and sips. Why not? Billable hours are, after all, billable hours.
"It was 1959. I was still on the point. I've always lived here except for the years in Tallahassee, and it's better not to speak of them. Although I now think part of the hate I felt for that provincial backwater of a town, perhaps even most of it, was simply a masked longing for the island and the dune. I kept wondering what I was missing, you see. Who I was missing. Being able to read obituaries in advance gives a man an extraordinary sense of power. Perhaps you find that unlovely. The truth often is. So, 1959. Harvey Beecher lawyering in Sarasota and living at Pelican Point. If it wasn't pouring down rain when I got home, I'd always change into old clothes and paddle out to the island for a look-see before supper. On this particular day, I'd been kept at the office late, and by the time I'd gotten out to the island, tied up and walked over to the dune side, the sun was going down, big and red, as it so often does over the gulf. What I saw stunned me. I literally could not move. There wasn't just one name written in the sand that evening, but many. And in that red sunset light, they looked as if they had been written in blood. They were crammed together,
They wove in and out. They were written over and above and up and down. The whole length and breadth of the dune was covered with a tapestry of names. The ones down by the water had been half erased.
Wayland looks awed in spite of his core disbelief.
I think I screamed. I can't remember for sure, but yes, I think so. What I do remember is breaking the paralysis and running away as fast as I could down the path to where my canoe was tied up. It seemed to take me forever to unpluck the knot, and when I did, I pushed the canoe out into the water before I climbed in. I was soaked from head to toe, and it's a wonder I didn't tip over. Although in those days I could have easily swum to shore pushing the canoe ahead of me.
Not these days. If I tipped my kayak over now, that would be all she rode. Then I suggest you stay on shore, at least until your will is signed, witnessed, and notarized. Judge Beecher gives the young man a wintry smile.
You needn't worry about that, son,
he says. He looks towards the window and the gulf beyond. His face is long and thoughtful.
Those names. I can see them yet, jostling each other for place on that blood-red dune. 2 days later, a TWA plane on its way to Miami crashed in the Glades. All 119 souls on board were killed. The passenger list was in the paper. I recognized some of the names. I recognized many of them.
You saw this? You saw those names?
Yes. For several months after that, I stayed away from the island, and I promised myself I would stay away for good. I suppose drug addicts make the same promises to themselves about their dope, don't they? And like them, I eventually weakened and resumed my old habit. Now, counselor, do you understand why I called you out here to finish the work on my will, and why it had to be tonight?
Wayland doesn't believe a word of it, but like many fantasies, this one has its own internal logic. It's easy enough to follow. The judge is 90. His once ruddy complexion has gone the color of clay. His formerly firm step has become shuffling and tentative. He's clearly in pain, and he's lost weight he can't afford to lose.
I suppose that today you saw your name in the sand, Wayland says.
Judge Beecher looks momentarily startled, and then he smiles. It is a terrible smile, transforming his narrow, pallid face into a death's head grin.
Oh, no, he says. Not mine.
Thinking of W.F. Harvey. Life is full of big questions, isn't it? Fate or destiny? Heaven or hell? Love or attraction? Reason or impulse? Beatles or Stones? For me, it was always the Stones. The Beatles were just too soft once they became Jupiter in the solar system of pop music. My wife used to refer to Sir Paul McCartney as old dog eyes, and that kind of summed up how I felt. But early Beatles, they played honest rock, and I still listen to those old tracks, mostly covers, with love. Sometimes I'm even moved to get up and dance a little. One of my favorites was their version of the Larry Williams classic, Bad Boy, with John Lennon singing lead in a hoarse, urgent voice. I particularly liked the exhorted punchline, "Now, Junior, behave yourself!" At some point, I decided I wanted to write a story about a bad little kid who moved into the neighborhood. Not a kid who was the devil's spawn. Not a kid who was possessed by some ancient demon a la The Exorcist. But just bad for bad's sake. Bad to the bone. The apotheosis of all the bad little kids who ever were. I saw him in shorts, with a propeller beanie on his head. I saw him always causing trouble and absolutely never behaving himself. This is the story that grew around that little kid, an evil version of Sluggo, Nancy's friend from the funny pages. An electronic version has appeared in France and also in Germany, where Bad Boy was no doubt a part of the Beatles' Star Club repertoire. This is its first publication in English.
Bad Little Kid, read by Dylan Baker.
One. The prison was 20 miles from the nearest small city on an otherwise empty expanse of prairie where the wind blew almost all the time. The main building was a looming stone horror perpetrated on the landscape at the beginning of the 20th century. Growing from either side were concrete cell blocks built one by one over the previous 45 years, mostly with federal money that began flowing during the Nixon years and just never stopped. At some distance from the main body of the prison was a smaller building. The prisoners called this adjunct Needle Manor. Jutting from one side of it was an outdoor corridor, 40 yards long, 20 feet wide, and enclosed in heavy chain-link fencing, the Chicken Run. Each Needle Manor inmate, currently there were 7, was allowed 2 hours in the Chicken Run each day. Some walked, some jogged. Most simply sat with their backs against the chain link, either staring up at the sky or looking at the low, grassy ridge that broke the landscape a quarter of a mile to the east. Sometimes there was something to look at, more often there was nothing. Almost always there was the wind. For 3 months of the year the Chicken Run was hot. The rest of the time it was cold. In the winter, it was frigid. The inmates usually chose to go out even then. There was the sky to look at, after all, birds. Sometimes deer feeding along the crest of that low ridge, free to go where they pleased. At the center of Needle Manor was a tiled room containing a Y-shaped table and a few rudimentary pieces of medical equipment. Set in one wall was a window with drawn curtains. When pulled back, they disclosed an observation chamber no bigger than the living room of a suburban tract house with a dozen hard plastic chairs where guests could view the Y-shaped table. On the wall was a sign reading, "Keep silent and make no gestures during the procedure." There were an even dozen cells in Needle Manor. Beyond them was a guard room. Beyond the guard room was a monitoring station, which was manned 24/7. Beyond the monitoring station was a consultation room, where a table on the inmate side was separated from the table on the visitor's side by thick plexiglass. There were no phones. Inmates conversed with their loved ones or legal representatives through a circle of small punched holes, like those in the mouthpiece of an old-fashioned telephone. Leonard Bradley sat down on his side of this communication port and opened his briefcase. He put a yellow legal pad and a uni-ball pen on the table. Then he waited. The second hand on his watch made 3 revolutions and started a 4th before the door leading to the inner regions of Needle Manor opened with a loud clack of withdrawing bolts. Bradley knew all the guards by now. This one was McGregor. Not a bad guy. He was holding George Hallis by the arm. Hallis's hands were free, but a steel snake of chain rattled along the floor between his ankles. There was a wide leather belt around the waist of his orange prison jumper, and when he sat down on his side of the glass, McGregor clipped another chain from a steel loop on the belt to a steel loop on the back of the chair. He locked it, gave it a tug, then tipped Bradley a 2-finger salute.
Afternoon, Counselor.
Afternoon, Mr. McGregor. Hallis said nothing.
You know the deal, McGregor said. As long as you want today, or as long as you can take him, at least.
I know. Ordinarily, lawyer-client consultations were limited to an hour. Beginning a month before the client's scheduled trip into the room with a Y-shaped table, consultation time was upped to 90 minutes, during which the lawyer and his increasingly squirrely partner in this state-mandated death waltz would discuss a diminishing number of shitty options. During the last week, there was no set time limit. This was true for close relatives as well as legal counsel, but Hallis's wife had divorced him only weeks after his conviction, and there were no children. He was alone in the world except for Len Bradley, but seemed to want little to do with any of the appeals and consequent delays Bradley had suggested. Until today, that was.
"He'll talk to you," McGregor had told him, after a brief 10-minute consultation the month before, one where Hallis's end of the conversation had mostly been no, and no, and no.
"When it gets close, he'll talk to you plenty. They get scared, see? They forget all about how they wanted to walk into the injection room with their heads up and their shoulders squared. They start figuring out it's not a movie. They're really gonna die. And then they want to try every appeal in the book."
Hallis didn't look scared, though. He looked the same as ever. A small man with bad posture, a sallow complexion, thinning hair, and eyes that looked painted on. He looked like an accountant, which he had been in his previous life, who had lost all interest in the numbers that had previously seemed so important to him.
"Enjoy your visit, boys," McGregor said, and went over to the chair in the corner.
There he sat, turned on his iPod, and stuffed his ears with music. His eyes never left them, however. The circle of speaking holes was too small to admit the passage of a pencil, but a needle was not out of the question.
"What can I do for you, George?"
For several moments, Hallis didn't answer. He studied his hands, which were small and weak-looking, not the hands of a murderer at all, you would have said. Then he looked up.
"You're a pretty good guy, Mr. Bradley."
Bradley was surprised by this, and didn't know how to reply. Hallis nodded, as if his lawyer had tried to deny it.
"Yes, you are. You kept on, even after I made it clear I wanted you to stop and let the process run its course. Not many court-appointeds would do that. They'd just say, yeah, whatever, and go on to the next loser some judge hands them. You didn't do that. You told me what moves you wanted to make, and when I told you not to make them, you went ahead anyway. If not for you, I would have been in the ground a year ago."
"We don't always get what we want, George." Hallis smiled briefly.
"Nobody knows that better than me. But it hasn't been all bad. I can admit that now. Mostly because of the chicken run. I like going out there. I like the wind on my face, even when it's a cold wind. I like the smell of the prairie grass, or seeing the day moon in the sky when it's full, or deer. Sometimes they jump around up there on the ridge and chase each other. I like that. Makes me laugh out loud sometimes."
"Life can be good. It can be worth fighting for."
"Some lives, I'm sure. Not mine. But I admire the way you've fought for it, just the same. I appreciate your dedication, so I'm going to tell you what I wouldn't say in court, and why I've refused to make any of the usual appeals, although I couldn't stop you from making them for me."
"Appeals made without the appellant's participation don't swing much weight in this state's courts, or the higher ones."
"You've also been very good about visiting me, and I appreciate that, too. Few people would show kindness to a convicted child murderer, but you have to me.
Once again, Bradley could think of no reply. Hallis had already said more in the last 10 minutes than in all their visits over the last 34 months.
I can't pay you anything, but I can tell you why I killed that child. You won't believe me, but I'll tell you anyway, if you want to hear.
Hallis peered through the holes in the scratched plexiglass and smiled.
You do, don't you? Because you're troubled by certain things. The prosecution wasn't, but you are.
Well, certain questions have occurred, yes.
But I did it. I had a .45 revolver, and I emptied it into that boy. There were plenty of witnesses, and surely you know that the appeals process would simply have dragged out the inevitable for another 3 years or 4 or 6. Even if I had participated fully, the questions you have pale before the bald fact of premeditated murder. Isn't that so? We could have argued diminished mental capacity.
Bradley leaned forward. And that's still possible. It's not too late, even now, not quite.
The insanity defense is rarely successful after the fact, Mr. Bradley.
He won't call me Len, Bradley thought. Not even after all this time.
He'll go to his death calling me Mr. Bradley. Rarely isn't the same as never, George. No, but I'm not crazy now. And I wasn't crazy then. I was never more sane. Are you sure you want to hear the testimony I wouldn't give in court? If you don't, that's fine. But it's all I have to give.
Of course I want to hear, Bradley said. He picked up his pen, but ended up not making a single note.
He only listened, hypnotized, as George Hallis spoke in his soft Mid-South accent.
2.
My mother, who was healthy all her short life, died of a pulmonary embolism 6 hours after I was born. This was in 1969. It must have been a genetic defect, because she was only 22. My father was 8 years older. He was a good man and a good dad. He was a mining engineer and worked mostly in the Southwest until I was 8. A housekeeper traveled around with us. Her name was Nona McCarthy, and I called her Mama Noni. She was black. I suppose he slept with her, although when I slipped into her bed, which I did on many mornings, she was always alone. It didn't matter to me, one way or the other. I didn't know what black had to do with anything. She was good to me. She made my lunches and read me the usual bedtime stories when my father wasn't home to do it, and that was all that mattered to me. It wasn't the usual setup. I suppose I knew that much, but I was happy enough. In 1977, we moved east to Talbot, Alabama, not far from Birmingham. That's an army town, Fort John Huey, but also coal country. My father was hired to reopen the Good Luck mines, 1, 2, and 3, and bring them up to environmental specifications, which meant breaking ground on new holes and designing a disposal system that would keep the waste from polluting the local streams. We lived in a nice little suburban neighborhood, in a house the Good Luck Company provided. Mama Noni liked it because my father turned the garage into a 2-room apartment for her. It kept the gossip down to a dull roar, I suppose. I helped him with the renovations on weekends, handing him boards and such. That was a good time for us. I was able to go to the same school for 2 years, which was long enough to make friends and get some stability. One of my friends was the girl next door. In a TV show or a magazine, we would have ended up sharing our first kiss in a treehouse, falling in love, and then going to the junior prom together when we finally made it to high school. But that was never going to happen to me and Marley Jacobs. Daddy never led me to believe we'd be staying in Talbot. He said there was nothing meaner than encouraging false hopes in a child. Oh, I might go to Mary Day Grammar School through the 5th grade, might even through the 6th, but eventually his good luck would run out and we'd be moving on. Maybe back to Texas or New Mexico, maybe up to West Virginia or Kentucky. I accepted this, and so did Mama Noni. My dad was the boss. He was a good boss, and he loved us. Just my opinion, but I don't think you can do much better than that. The second thing had to do with Marley herself. She was, well, these days people would call her mentally challenged, but back then the folks in our neighborhood just said she was soft in the head. You could call that mean, Mr. Bradley, but looking back on it, I think it's just right. Poetic, even. She saw the world that way. All soft and out of focus. Sometimes, often, even, that can be better. Again, just my opinion. We were both in 3rd grade when I met her, but Marley was already 11. We were both promoted to the 4th grade the next year, but in her case it was just so they could keep moving her along through the system. That's how things worked in places like Talbot back then. And it wasn't like she was the village idiot. She could read a little and do some simple addition, but subtraction was beyond her. I tried to explain it every way I knew how, but she was just never going to get it. We never kissed in a treehouse, never kissed at all, but we always held hands when we walked to school in the morning and back in the afternoon. I imagine we looked damn funny, because I was a shrimp and she was a big girl, at least 4 inches taller than me, and already getting her breasts. It was her who wanted to hold hands, not me, but I didn't mind. I didn't mind that she was soft-headed either. I would have in time, I suppose, but I was only 9 when she died, still in an age when kids accept pretty much everything that's put before them. I think that's a blessed way to be. If everyone was soft in the head, do you think we'd still have wars? Balls we would. If we had lived another 1/2 mile out, Marley and I would have taken the bus. But since we were close to the Mary Day, 6 or 8 blocks, we walked. Mama Noni would hand me my bag lunch and smooth down my cowlick, and tell me, "You be a good boy now, Georgie," and send me out the door. Marley would be waiting outside her door, wearing one of her dresses or jumpers, with her hair done up in pigtails and ribbons, and her lunchbox in her hand. I can still see that lunchbox. It had Steve Austin on it, the $6 million man. Her mama would be standing in the doorway, and she'd say, "Hey now, Georgie." And I'd say, "Hey now, Mrs. Jacobs." And she'd say, "You children be good." And Marley would say, "We'll be good, Mama." And then Marley would take hold of my hand and off we'd go down the sidewalk. We had the first couple of blocks to ourselves, but then the other kids would start streaming in from Rudolph Acres. That was where a lot of Army families lived, because it was cheap and Fort Huey was only 5 miles north on Highway 78. We must have looked funny, the pipsqueak with his sack lunch holding hands with the beanpole banging her Steve Austin lunchbox against one scabby knee, but I don't remember anyone making fun or teasing. I suppose they must have from time to time, kids being kids and all, but if so, it was the light kind that doesn't mean much. Mostly once the sidewalk filled up, it was boys saying stuff like, "Hey now, George, you want to play pickup after school?" Or girls saying, "Hey now, Marley, Ain't those hair ribbons some pretty? I don't remember anyone treating us bad. Not until the bad little kid. One day after school, Marley didn't come out, and didn't come out. This must have been not long after my 9th birthday, because I had my bolo bouncer. Mama Noni gave it to me, and it didn't last long. I hit it too hard, and the rubber snapped. But I had it that day, and was going frontsies backsies with it while I waited for her. Nobody ever told me I had to wait for her. I just did. Finally, she came out, and she was crying. Her face was all red, and there was snot coming out of her nose. I asked her what was wrong, and she said she couldn't find her lunchbox. She ate her lunch out of it, same as always, she said, and put it back on the shelf in the cloakroom next to Kathy Morse's pink Barbie lunchbox, just like she always did. But when the going-home bell rang, it was gone. Somebody stole it, she said. No, no, somebody just moved it, and it'll be there tomorrow, I said. You stop your fussing and stand still now. You got a mess. Mama Noni always made sure I had a hanky when I left the house, but I wiped my nose on my sleeve like the other boys, because a hanky seemed kind of sissy. So it was still clean and still folded when I took it out of my back pocket and wiped the snot off her face with it. She stopped crying and smiled and said it tickled. Then she took my hand and we walked on toward home, just like always, her talking 6 licks to a dozen. I didn't mind, because at least she had forgotten her lunchbox. Pretty soon all the other kids were gone, although we could hear them laughing and skylarking their way back to Rudolph Acres. Marley was chitter-chattering along like always, anything that came into her head. I let it wash over me, saying, yeah, and uh-huh, and hey, mostly thinking about how I'd change into my old corduroys as soon as I got back, and if Mama Noni didn't have any chores for me, I'd get my glove and run down to the Oak Street playground and get in on the pickup game that went on there every day until Mom started yelling it was supper time. That is when we heard someone hollering at us from the other side of School Street, only it was less like a voice and more like a donkey bray. George and Marley up in a tree. K-I-S-S-I-N-G. We stopped. There was a kid over there, standing by a hackberry bush. I'd never seen him before, not at Merry Day or anywhere else. He wasn't but 4.5 feet tall and stocky. He had on gray shorts that went down all the way to his knees and a green sweater with orange stripes. It was rounded out up top with little boy tits and a poochy belly underneath. He had a beanie on his head, the stupid kind with a plastic propeller. His face was pudgy and hard at the same time. His hair was orange, like the stripes on his sweater, that shade nobody loves. It was all sprayed out on the sides over his jug ears. His nose was a little blot underneath the brightest, greenest eyes I've ever seen. He had a sulky Cupid's bow of a mouth, the lips so red it looked like he was wearing his ma's lipstick. I've seen plenty of carrot tops with those red lips since then, but none as red as that bad little kid's were. We stood and stared at him. Marley's chatter came to a halt. She had cat's-eye glasses with pink rims, and behind them her eyes were wide and magnified. The kid, he couldn't have been more than 6 or 7, pooched up those red lips of his and made kissy face noises. Then he put his hands on his butt and began to bump his hips at us. George and Marley up in a tree, F-U-C-K-I-N-G, bran. Just like a donkey. We stared, amazed.
You better wear a scumbag when you fuck her,
he called over, smirking those red lips.
Lest you want to have a bunch of retards just like her.
You shut up your face, I said.